Yes, indeed. A big thank you to the Brekkie team for kickstarting another day. But don't go away, because in the next half an hour, we've got The Science Show with No Name back again for another week. This week, we're featuring rocket cars down around Wollongong somewhere. We've got a bunch of secret sounds and all the very latest in science news. So stick around. Yes, indeed. It is The Science Show with No Name back again for another week. I'm Chris Stewart, and joining me here in the studio, we've got Ian Wolfe, we've got Matt Francis, we've got Adam Richardson, and we've got Jackie Hayes. And joining us is an old soul from the Science Show here on this very network is Gina Satori sitting in the background. We might hear a bit of a squeak from her later on. Over the next half an hour, we've got a whole packload of science for you. We've got rocket cars whipping around. We've got secret sounds that we're all going to have to see if we can guess what the hell they are. And as usual, we're going to kickstart everything off with the very latest in science news with Matt Francis.
In a memorable scene from the classic sci-fi movie Back to the Future, the mad scientist Doc Brown fuels up his time machine using a small device from the future labelled Mr. Fusion. But according to researchers from UCLA, the idea of room temperature fusion using a tabletop device is now in fact a reality. The device uses two opposing crystals to generate a powerful electric field. In this field, a gas of deuterium, a heavier cousin of hydrogen, is literally ripped apart, with the outer electrons of the deuterium atoms being stripped away. The positively charged nucleus that remains is then accelerated onto a target in one of the crystals at a great enough speed to fuse with atoms in the target. This is one of the first examples of nuclear fusion using such a simple and compact device, and the researchers hope to develop it into a portable, battery-operated unit. While this technique is not seen as a viable means of generating power, the fusion generates a steady beam of neutrons. Neutron sources have a wide range of uses in scientific research, as well as diagnosis and treatment applications in medicine. A recent study has found that the first inklings of racism may develop in infants as young as 6 months old. This controversial research, conducted at Tel Aviv University, was conducted by getting a group of infants, 3 months old, sitting them on their mother's lap, and then placing a picture of someone from their own race and someone from another race in front of them. The researchers recorded how long the babies looked at each picture and found that babies tended to have a preference towards looking longer at the picture from their own race. But what startled the researchers was that babies that were raised in mixed ethnicity environments actually did not show this preference, showing perhaps that people being raised amongst people of their own ethnicity is in fact possibly a determination of racism. This study hopes to find what causes racism in young people in order to perhaps prevent this stage of development. Cane toads are amongst one of Australia's most reviled pests and a continual embarrassing reminder about just how wrong we can be when we try and mess with nature. However, as if things weren't bad enough, it seems that the world's ugliest ball of slime is now mutating into super toads. Researchers from the University of Sydney have been tracking the advance of the toad horde across the Northern Territory towards Darwin. Startlingly, the front line of the toads' invasion force has been found to have much longer legs than cane toads that are settled in habitats in North Queensland. Longer legs mean longer hops, and hence a greater speed of movement. This is seen as a classic example of Darwinian evolution, with the stronger toads better able to stake a claim into new territory. It also explains the mystery of the accelerating advance of the toads. In the early days of toads' infestation, before the 1960s, the toads were advancing their territory by only 10 kilometres a year. In recent years, however, this has grown to more than 50 kilometres every year. The predicted eventual range of cane toad population reaches as far south as Victoria and as far west as Broome, and it seems the mutant toads are keen to get there as fast as possible.
And that was the science news here on this Science Show Without a Name. My name's Chris Stewart. The 6th annual Rocket Car Day was held in the back streets of Marrickville in Sydney. I said earlier it was in Wollongong. They're not that far apart, you know, if you're listening around the world. They're only just this far on the map. Ian Wolfe went along for a lot of the fun. Ian, how'd it go?
Rocket Car Day 666, the most evil race on the planet. Rocket Car Day's a semi-random event that brings together a collection of misfits and engineers to race model cars powered by model rocket engines. They take over an industrial alley somewhere, and on Rocket Car Day they deliver danger, excitement and warped inventiveness in a What a Nice Day style package. That's the slogan of the 6th annual Rocket Car Day at www.rocketcarday.com. What you're about to hear is a typical race. There's the countdown, ignition, there are cheers for a car travelling in a straight line, and another cheer when it stops and the distance is recorded. The car that travels the furthest wins. Entrants get something or make something, attach a model rocket engine and wheels. Although it's a family day with children watching, spectators are warned to keep their distance and be prepared to get out of the way when cars in the untested category are raced, as they might steer into the crowd by accident. The untested category included a VB car that was lovingly crafted from beer cans. There's also a car that was one giant wheel with a rocket on the top to spin it. There were several cars made out of Lego, carefully glued to take the acceleration and impact. There was a toy Godzilla mounted on wheels holding a rocket in its mouth. The rocket was too high above the wheels, so the car just spun in place. Getting the physics wrong doesn't lead to winning at Rocket Car Day. The evil category is all about style. One car was a long wooden cross with a goth doll crucified on it that was set alight when it was raced. It was very popular to add a little toy pilot. The ultimate this year was a Mr. T figure that was mounted on top of a car made from a larger Mr. T motorbike with a rocket mounted up the backside. I pity the fool who doesn't enjoy T-on-T action. There was a spaceman with wheels on his face and feet. The Godzilla car had a second try, with two rockets being held in his hands for greater stability and force. It still toppled over at ignition and spun in place. In the tested category, there were cars that had webcams, onboard computers using solid-state gyroscopes for steering. There were long aerodynamic cars made from bamboo and others crafted from aluminium or laminated cardboard. Some were modified skateboards, and one was a modified toy car with a tiny cage wheel with a toy panda as the pilot. The main challenge to racers is to keep it straight when the rocket engine ignites. The basics for making this work are a longer axle to make it harder for the cars to spin, put the engine at the back, oil your wheels, line up the engine with the wheels, get the rocket close to the centre of gravity. If the car's too heavy, it won't go very far, and if it's too light, it'll go a long way, but anywhere. And a little drogue line of ribbons and streamers at the back adds stability and looks good. Having a little toy man seems to help. A C-sized model rocket motor can deliver about 6 newtons of thrust. They fire an ejection charge after about 3 seconds, which normally would deploy a parachute for recovery in a vertical rocket. They just provide a final bang for the rocket cars. Typically, the engines are black gunpowder in a clay matrix, wrapped in cardboard with a smoke-generating load for tracing the rocket. They're ignited by a spark from wires leading to an external power supply. For Rocket Car Day, the multi-car ignition system is made to look like a big detonator with a plunger. It has sets of wires leading away from it for every car in the race, with a capacity for 6 at a time. Model rocket motors are available all over the counter in hobby and model shops around Australia.
That's gold. That's fabulous stuff. I can remember as a kid, I used to go along with a friend of mine, this is up in Queensland, in Toowoomba, to space pilots. Anyone ever hear of space pilots? It was kind of like scouts for rocket nerds. And they would have these cardboard tubes and they'd put these rockets in the bottom of them and they'd go up in the air. Well, sometimes they would. Most of the times they'd fall over and fire off into the crowd. And it seemed to be that the excitement was much more about, hey, it blew up, than it actually got up in the air. And I think this is the horizontal version of space pilots.
That's it.
Fabulous stuff.
It's a family day out with beer and barbecue.
I remember my mum telling me a story about when she was younger, she used to do this sort of thing, and she had a little snail as a pilot. Fortunately, the pilot wasn't recovered.
So, Sorry, I'm glad to hear that your mum was involved, because I was thinking when I was listening to this, you know, what is it about boys and long pointy things that go really fast and then make a loud noise? I'm slightly concerned. I've seen the photos.
It's the danger.
There are several women who built rocket cars as well.
Yeah, it wasn't all just boys, Gina. Thank you for your Freudian analysis of this. I was just thinking, though, this is a nicely testosterone-loaded show, and we're off to a really good start here, I think.
You think I'd fly 30,000 miles across perilous land and sea, but instead I'll sit right here and miss her terribly. But I know that you can't help from what your career choice is, that you are in the business of connecting people's voices. Should I tell you where all this is leading? Operator, get me Sweden. In a letter, but to do them justice, to speak them would be better. Oh. While the moon pushes me down to sleep, a sun comes up and starts her. I hope this feeling stays preserved in me, just like the Vasa. Get me sleeping. Use any methods you require to get her on. Because you are this Earth's long-distance love ambassador. To speak to her tonight, I would take anything. By means of fiber optics or two tin cans on a string. Oh. I really must apologize for my compulsive behavior. One left his heart in San Francisco, mine's in Scandinavia. By one who's communicationally keyed in. Operator, get me Sweden. Get me Sweden. Get me Sweden.
That was Darren Hanlon with a little track called Operator, Get Me Sweden. Well, you're listening to The Science Show Without a Name, and one of the mainstays of radio around the world is the listener-fed competition where you get to try to guess the secret sound. Now, on this show, we've done this a couple of times over the years, where we've played a secret sound, but it's not just any old secret sound. This is a secret sound from science. Now, on this evening's show, on today's show, Adam Richardson was given the task of doing a feature, and he's a bit lazy. He's just simply come up with a bunch of sounds, and he wants us to guess what they are. So, Adam, we're game. Everyone in here is ready for you. What have you got for us?
All right, let's see how good you are. Scientists generally try and use numbers and facts and figures to describe the world around them, but sometimes it doesn't quite cut it. Sometimes they have to use their ears or their eyes or smell things to try and figure out what's going on.
All right.
Eyes and smelling don't really work too well on radio, so we're going to focus on some sounds.
Cool.
So, our first sound, if we could cue that one up, please.
All right, first sound. Okay, it's short, it's sweet, and it's annoying.
Very, very annoying, but what is it?
Sounds a little bit like a mosquito.
It sounds a lot like a mosquito.
I was thinking, I know that sound from lying in bed at night when you've turned the lights off, you're just drifting off to sleep, and there it is, and it's in your ear.
It's actually much, much, much bigger than a mosquito, though.
Much bigger.
If that thing was in your ear, your head would hurt.
Oh, okay. It's a hippo. Hippo mosquito. No. Are we talking Animal Kingdom?
No, we're not.
Are we talking something off this earth?
We could be.
Are we talking something in outer space?
We could be.
Are we talking something kind of like a pulsary type star?
That is one of the fastest pulsars found so far.
Is that known as the annoying pulsar?
They're all pretty annoying.
The cosmic mosquito.
That one is, its technical name is B1937 plus 21.
Now, just for those who aren't up on their pulsar science, what is a pulsar?
Okay, a pulsar is a star that's collapsed in on itself, and as it collapses, it starts to spin a bit faster.
So is this after a supernova?
Yeah, sort of.
Okay,
so after a supernova or anything else that causes...
Star gets to the end of its life and it just goes, oh, bugger, I've had enough. Collapses down and starts spinning around really quick.
That's right. And it starts to throw off some little particles that get caught in very strong magnetic fields. And the magnetic fields actually accelerate the particles out and you get these great big jets shooting out off them.
And is it the sort of oscillation sound because it's spinning around?
That's right. Every time that the jet passes the Earth, it's like a lighthouse. The beam shines on us. We hear a bright tick on a radio, and that particular one's traveling at 700 hertz, so it's spinning around 700 times a second.
Which is mind-boggling when you think that's a star.
I know that
thing's spinning
15 kilometers across, spinning at 700 times a second. That means if you were standing on the surface of it, you would be moving at a seventh of the speed of light.
Man,
that's bloody quick.
Still annoying.
Okay, moving along.
On to number two.
Number two.
Okay, it's sounding to me a little bit like when you're in a tent and it starts raining. And you're thinking, there's no way I'm getting up.
Just before the mosquitoes come.
Just before the mosquitoes come.
It sounds like a radioactive mosquito to me.
Radioactive mosquito?
Thinking a bit of a firecracker, something sort of crackling, burning.
About to go off.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
I'm looking for a wildebeest through a grass
Geiger counter.
You are all so far off.
Okay, well, give us a
hint. We're thinking outer space again.
Outer space again, okay.
These are strongest.
Something staticky from outer space?
Well, closer to inner space, but it's space.
Oh, okay, so are we talking something atmospheric?
No.
Oh.
Not Earth.
Oh. So solar system?
Solar system.
Solar system.
Jupiter?
No.
The sun?
Ooh. No.
Okay, I give up, sir.
Okay, this one is actually recorded by the Huygens space probe as it flew between the rings of Saturn. And as it was flying between the rings, little bits of debris that actually make up the ring. Okay, it wasn't flying through the ring because there the particles are just so intense it would rip this thing to shreds. It's moving at 80,000 kilometers an hour, roughly. But flying between the rings, there's still a few particles that are about the size of smoke. And as they hit the radio receiver on the nose of this spaceship, they convert to plasma, and the plasma creates the little tick that you heard. So every one of those little flicks that we were hearing was actually a particle falling on the Huygens space probe as it travelled through Saturn's rings.
Isn't that amazing? Because, I mean, it's one of the most well-known images of outer space is Saturn and its beautiful rings. But, you know, they look so, you know, ethereal. but they're actually little chunks of stuff, right? And
yep.
many of those chunks are tiny. You said it's like smoke, like the particles in smoke. But of course, if you're traveling at spacecraft speeds, which are very, very quick indeed, even going through smoke is going to really hurt you unless you're really careful. So that's what we're listening to.
That's what that one was. So
wow.
Okay, we'll move along. Now, the next one is really, really hard. That's a warning.
All right.
And
okay,
I actually have a cleaned up version of that. So I'll give you a hint. That one was underwater.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen carefully, there's a lot of other noise, like ships moving around and that
sort of
thing.
I was just going to say I could hear a ship.
So I filtered.
There we go.
I spent the last 3 hours listening to it. There's a ship there, trust me.
Okay, so
I filtered the ships out and we have the cleaned up version. Okay, a hint. That one's actually been sped up 16 times.
So it's a really slow,
really slow
farting noise.
It's coral farting.
No. Over several months.
It's so good to have you back, Gina.
I think I raised the tone of the show.
Okay, are we talking something which is sort of animal in origin?
We believe so.
We believe so?
We believe so.
It's a mysterious animal origin farting noise.
This one, it actually hasn't been explained yet. It was detected about 10 years ago. They heard it several times, but they were unable to figure out what it was. Judging from the sound of it, they think it's an animal. Problem is, they heard it from over 5,000 kilometres away. So an animal that you can hear that loudly 5,000 kilometres away is bloody loud.
This is cheating. You can't do a secret. You can't do a secret sound and then say no one knows.
Well, the whole point of this secret sound is to show that scientists have to use their ears, and scientists are using their ears on this one, and they can't figure it out.
Then they've got to use more than their ears, and your whole point is invalid.
They have to listen a bit longer.
I think the point is well taken. That science is sometimes just damn hard.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for pointing that out, Adam. Indeed, you are listening to The Science Show Without a Name for another week. Coming towards the end of the show, but we've just got time for a bit of an and finally. Ian, you've got some stuff about annoying teenagers and how to get rid of them.
Yes, there's always the problem that the oldies want to get rid of the teenagers. They just hang around your shops and they don't buy things, and these
teenagers.
Young people could cause trouble. So what the Staffordshire Police have done is they've given the Moreland shopkeepers a device that's worth about $1,500 that plays sounds that are only heard by people between the ages of 12 and around 22, about 20 hertz at the bottom end of the scale. So it's a really high bottom end of the scale, the high end of the scale, I should say. It's a very high-pitched sound that older people can't hear. Now, they promise it's not loud enough to hurt anyone. It's just annoying. And so because it's annoying, the teenagers go away.
Now, why is it that only the teenagers can hear this? What happens to your hearing as you get older?
Well, as you get older, the higher frequencies, which should be 20 kilohertz rather than 20 hertz, which is the low end, 20 kilohertz, the hairs in your ear hear lower and lower frequencies. They're not as they don't have as wide a range. Hairs actually fall out.
Right. So your hearing is good when you're young, And then as you get older, that range that you can hear just contracts.
That's exactly
right.
So
we're taking advantage of that by going, well, old people can't hear this, so let's just blast the hell out of the kids and
exactly
annoy them. Nice.
Because we don't trust the young people not to be committing crimes.
Were these developed, I wonder? Because you can get sort of just to plug in just in your house really high frequency ones to deter insects and those sort of pests. So I guess they're just a bit of an adaptation to deter a different type of pest. Or
exactly.
Maybe the idea came from someone at home one day who plugged one of these in and the annoying teenager went, turn that down. And they went, hey, here's a $1 million idea. We'll start flogging these old people. Nice idea. What does it sound like? It'd probably sound like something like, really annoying. Like,
only just a little bit higher. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And apparently they've experimented. They've got fabulous results, but $1,500 a pop.
Nice. Well, if you're out there and you're plagued by either insects or annoying teenagers, then if you've got a spare $1,500, have we got a device for you? Davis there taking us out with a bit of a slow groove. You've been listening to The Science Show with No Name for another week. My name's Chris Stewart and I've been joined in the studio this week by Ian Wolfe, Adam Richardson, Matt Francis and our old buddy, not old, our long-standing buddy, Gina Satori. Jackie Hayes was behind the panel, being panel goddess this week, pushing the buttons and sliding the slider things in all the right directions. And we recorded the show up here, as usual, in the plush velvet studios of 2SER in Sydney. The show goes out around Australia thanks to the Community Broadcasting Network. And of course, if you're listening to us via podcast, that must be because you've pointed your podcast browser of choice towards feeds.feedburner.com/Discovery Radio. We're not allowed to say that name strictly, but we'll say it anyway. If you want to send us an email, let us know how things are going, if you've got a question or a comment, or you just want to say hi, send it to discovery@2ser.com. Still got the old email address. We'll see how it goes. Thanks for sticking around for the last half an hour. Join us again next week for much more sciencey goodness on The Science Show with No Name. We'll get a name soon, we promise.